The following is an excerpt from the book, The Best Things, by James Russell Miller. Chapter 2. Think on these things. There are certain single phases of life that are far-reaching in their influence. The habit of cheerfulness, for instance, is said to be worth to a man many thousands a year. The habit of being always an encourager, never a discourager, gives incalculable value to one's personality and influence. A discourager is a misanthrope. He makes life harder for every other life he touches. And an encourager is a constant inspiration to others and makes life easier for everyone. There's another habit of life which, if it were to become universal, would change many things, namely, the habit of always seeing the good in people, in conditions, in circumstances, and in experiences. St. Paul suggests it when he says in a remarkable passage, "If there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things." The emphasis seems to be on any. If there be any virtue, even the least, in another. If there be in a life which seems almost wholly bad, even the smallest thing that is good, where to find that, and to think upon that mere speck of beauty, rather than on the much that is evil and unbeautiful. If there be in a person any praise, any smallest quality or act that is worthy of praise, of which we can speak with even the faintest approval and commendation, we should give thought to that, and voice our appreciation, rather than think and speak of the many things in the person that are not good or praiseworthy. It's easy to think of reasons why this is the Christian way. It's Christ's way with us. If there be any good, even the faintest spark of virtue or hope in a life, Christ sees it. He's looking for good and hopeful things. Some people see only the faults and flaws in the lives of others. They're looking for these things, blemishes, defects, imperfections. They're never trying to find anything beautiful, and they find what they seek. Our Master, however, is looking for things that are right, good beginnings of better things. Someone asked the curator of an Academy of Fine Arts regarding the pictures of a certain artist, "What do you consider the defects in his work?" The answer was, "We don't look for defects here, but for excellences." It's thus that our Master does in our lives. He doesn't look for the imperfections, of which there are always many, but for things that are worthy of commendation. If there be any virtue, he finds it, takes note of it, nourishes it, woos it out. If Christ looked upon us as we too often look upon others, seeing the flaws, the shortcomings, the inconsistencies, the failures, and judged us by these, not many of us ever would grow into beauty. But where there is even a spark of good, he finds it and cultivates it into its best possibilities. We shall never become of much use in the world until we learn this lesson of always finding and encouraging the best. We shall never lift up anyone to a higher, better life until we found in him something to approve and commend. There are some men and women who wish to help others, to be of use to them, but work after a wrong method. They think they must eliminate the faults and defects which they find, and so they watch for things that they can't approve. They have keen eyes for specks. None are too small for them to see, but they never see the beautiful things in another. The Master refers to such persons in his teaching about motes and beams. He would have us look for the good, not the evil in others. There's no life so devoid of beauty and good that it has in it nothing worth of commendation. Ruskin found even in the mud of London streets the elements out of which gems are formed, the opal, the sapphire, the diamond. The love of Christ finds even in the moral refuse of this world possibilities of loveliness in character and heavenliness in life. We can't do anything to help men by indulging in criticism and denunciation. We can call out the good in others only as the sun woos out the plants and flowers from the cold earth in the springtime, by its warmth. If the friends of Christ would cease their fault-finding and become true friends of men, finding the smallest beginnings of virtue and encouraging them, the earth would soon be changed into a garden. We are continually meeting those who are discouraged, who have fallen under the shadow of misfortune, who have done wrong, perhaps, and are suffering in reputation, or who have been unjustly treated and are enduring the sting. These are the persons to whom our love should go out in words of hope and cheer instead of blame. James Whitcomb Riley teaches the lesson in his well-known lines, "When over the fair fame of friend or foe, the shadow of disgrace shall fall, instead of words of blame or proof of thus and so, let something good be said. Forget not that no fellow being yet may fall so low, but love may lift his head. Even the cheek of shame with tears is wet if something good be said. No generous heart may vainly turn aside in ways of sympathy. No soul so dead but may awaken strong and glorified if something good be said. And so I charge ye, by the thorny crown and by the cross on which the Savior bled, and by your own soul's hope of fair renown, let something good be said." One of the most significant words of personal experience in the Old Testament is that in which David tells us at the close of his wonderful life that all he had attained and achieved, he owed to God's gentleness. "Thy gentleness hath made me great." If God had been harsh with him, stern, critical, severely exacting, David would never have reached the noble life with its wonderful achievements, which he finally attained. If God had been severe with him after his falls and failures, David never would have risen to power and distinction. God's gentleness made him great. We can help others to become great only by being patient with them. Men and women everywhere need nothing so much as gentleness. So many gods, so many creeds, so many paths that wind and wind, when just the art of being kind is all this sad world needs. Are not many of us too brusque with each other? Do we not lack in kindliness and patience and tenderness? Some men would have us believe that gentleness is an unmanly quality, but it's not. Rudeness and harshness are always unmanly. Gentleness is divine. For many people, life is not easy, and we make it much harder for them to live worthily when we deal harshly with them, when we're exacting, when we chide or blame, or when we exercise our wits in saying smart, cutting, and irritating things to annoy and vex them. It was said of William Cullen Bryant that he treated every neighbor as if he were an angel in disguise. That is, he had a feeling akin to reverence for everyone who entered his presence. We don't know to whom we're speaking when we meet a stranger any of these common days. Let's treat him as the poet did his neighbor, as if he were an angel. Cardinal Newman defines a gentleman as one who never needlessly causes pain to another. If we are followers of Christ, we have no right to be ungentle, to be ill-mannered, to act disagreeably, to treat any other one rudely, brusquely. If there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. We should never forget the teaching of our Master that the hungry person we feed in his name, the sick person we visit, the stranger to whom we show kindness, the discouraged person we encourage, the fainting one we lift up and start on his way again, is the Master himself. Insomuch as you did it unto one of these my brethren, even these least, ye did it unto me. How would we treat Jesus if we found him in any condition of need? That is to be the test in our dealings with men. We dare not be ungentle to anyone. It may be an angel unaware. It may be Christ himself. The teaching applies to our own personal experience of sorrow. We should seek the line of brightness in any dark picture and think of that. And there are always breaks in the clouds through which we can see the blue and the stars. No lot in life is ever so utterly hopeless as to have in it nothing to alleviate its unhappiness. There's always something of brightness, one line at least, in the darkest experience. You scarce can wander in a wood so dense at night, but if the heavens be clear, some trembling star rejoicing in its grateful light gleams through the atmosphere. You scarce can tread a track so sadly dark in life, but if your heart be right, some kindly hope benignly beaming o'er your strife illuminates the night. There always are comforts, no matter how great the sorrow. Every cloud has on it some bit of silver lining. There are hopes, consolations, encouragements, and every experience of grief or loss, and we are to think of these and not alone of the sad elements in the experience. One chill day, a beam of sunshine, coming into the parlor through the shutters, made a bright spot on the carpet. The little dog that had been lying in the dark corner of the room got up at once and went and lay down in the patch of sunshine. And that's what we should do in our larger life. When into any darkness or gloom of ours, even the faintest ray of light streams, we should accept it and sit down in its brightness. There's a reason for gratitude in the most bitter experience. We should find that and enjoy its brightness. We should turn our eyes from the clouds and look at the stars. Live in the sunshine. God meant it for you. Live as the robins and sing the day through. Think on the good, not the evil. Think on the loveliness, not on the disfigurements. Think on the pure, not on the soiled. Think on the hopeful things in men, their possibilities of nobleness, not on their faults. In sorrow, find the face of Christ and gaze on that till you forget your grief. In all life, if there be any virtue, any praise, any beauty, any joy, think on these things, and it will lift up your life into strength, nobleness, divineness.